Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guests, Professors Ruth Ben-Ghiat and Jason Stanley, have been warning about Donald Trump's fascist behaviors and how he has fueled extremism for years. Ruth Ben-Ghiat is professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. She writes about fascism, authoritarian leaders, propaganda, and threats to democracy around the world and how to counter them. Professor Ben-Ghiat's latest book is Strong Men, From Mussolini to the Present. It is the first study to place Donald Trump in the context of a century of authoritarian leaders that use a playbook of corruption, violence, propaganda, and machismo to stay in power. In a recent piece for CNN, Professor Ben-Ghiat writes, quote, Trump promised law and order, but delivered lawlessness. His extremist rhetoric and attempts to undo the voice and will of American voters were aided and abetted by the Republican Party, an organization that, thanks to Trump, has left democracy behind. Today, the mask is finally off, and Americans can see the true ideology of Trump and his allies, power to be held onto at any cost. Hi, Professor Ben-Ghiat. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University. Jason Stanley writes about propaganda, free speech, and authoritarianism. Professor Stanley's latest book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. In a recent piece for the Daily Beast, he writes, quote, Under Trump, the Republican Party seeks one-party rule in the service of a kind of cult of the leader who promises a restoration of greatness supposedly destroyed by liberals, immigrants, minorities, and socialists. In short, what seems to be emerging in the Republican Party is a kind of modern-day fascism. In this system, anyone who is not loyal to the leader or the leader's party is treated as illegitimate, denounced as socialist, a communist, or a useful dupe of these ideologies. Hi, Professor Stanley. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your work.
Thank you so much.
Well, here we are. It's Tuesday, almost a week out. And we've now learned, or we're learning, a lot about what really happened. So much is coming out in the press. Now that you both have had time to really process last week's attack, you both have written about it. What are you thinking about right now, and what concerns you the most? Professor Ghiat, let's start with you.
So one thing, well, many things concern me, starting with that, you know, as more information comes out about who participated in this, we need to drop the narrative that these were kind of extremist outliers, misfits, ragtags. And I know some of the people who dressed up in animal costumes and took pictures could give that impression. But as we learn who was part of this, it was Republican donors, Republican officials, you know, members of the law enforcement, members of the military. So the threat to our democracy is inside our institutions. It's not just outside on the part of extremists. So this is part of Donald Trump's success he's had with legitimating extremism, but also shifting the political culture of the GOP further rightward so that extremists and elected officials become one and the same thing.
We're actually going to do a show about that tomorrow, about what we know about members of off-duty police. CNN also says some firefighters are now under investigation, and members of the military. Professor Stanley, what about you? What would you add?
So, as usual, I follow Professor Ben-Ghiat's wisdom and insight, and have for years on these topics, and everything she said, I would just second. My wife, who's a physician, was telling me, she's an African-American physician, and she was noting that people on various message boards of African-American physicians were talking about physicians they knew, even African-American physicians who were members of the Proud Boys. It's much more, Donald Trump, as Professor Ben-Ghiat said, has legitimized this. And what happens when you legitimize it is though people might dress up as disaffected, economically anxious, working class, white working class people, this crosses all classes. and as you say, runs through law enforcement. I mean, in the history of when you look at say, Victor Klemperer's Language of the Third Reich or literature on the Rwandan genocide, what you find is that violent rhetoric by political leaders precedes large-scale violence by several years. And so what I'm concerned about, thinking about that, is the way that the violent rhetoric we've seen historically after a period of several years eventuates in mass action.
Professor Stanley, did I hear you right? Black doctors, your wife is in various online forums, and she's learning that black doctors are members of the Proud Boys?
I don't want to out the forums of it, but the Proud Boys have there are black. I mean, the ideology here is an ideology. There's anti-Muslim ideology. There's Christian nationalism. What's coalescing here is not simply white supremacy. It's not simply patriarchy. That's why I'm choosing to use the word fascism, because we need some word that is intersects a variety of things that explains. That explains how many people are part of this mass right-wing movement, far-right movement.
I think you bring up such an important point, because after Trump won the election, I think so many of us wanted a simplistic answer. How did this man win? Even this time, how did this man get more than 74 million votes, more than he got in 2016? And we would all like a simple answer, but there are many layers to this. So can you elaborate on this, Professor Stanley, that we can't just call these people white supremacists, that there are, I mean, when you take a look, the New York Times and Reuters has, and the AP have done really incredible reporting looking at the different individuals and their backgrounds, and you could put them in so many different boxes.
Well, I think Professor Ben-Ghiat's work, which comes from a gender perspective, Professor Ben-Ghiat's work looks at the way patriarchy appeals to people, including women, with this kind of strong male authoritarian leader, is certainly central to the mix. But we've got to put nation, race, and gender all together into this mix. We certainly have to put Christian nationalism into this mix. So we've had this long. You know, we've had a long recent history of a mixture of ideologies, anti-government ideologies. So if you just look at the Republican Party has built itself up by saying government is the enemy. Government is the enemy because it funnels your money to black people. So that brings together libertarians who may not be racist with white supremacists under an umbrella that targets the U.S. government. And that's going to be a broad anti-government target. And that's part of the structure that led us to where we are.
Professor Ben-Ghiat, what would you add on that?
So one of the things I wanted to do in my book is find patterns in history so that we can understand what was happening to us in the United States, and that no country is immune from this situation of having an authoritarian leader move the whole political culture rightwards. And one of the things we find is that these figures have an appeal when there's been a huge amount of social change. It could that means something in different places, different times, but when there's been gender emancipation, progress in racial equity, workers' rights, so that the same things that leave some people feeling overjoyed leave other people angry and wanting to reverse this. So these figures come up and they use this kind of the glamour of males as protectors. Even as they, as you said, in quoting from my CNN piece, they legitimize lawlessness. So they come up to shake everything up, but at the same time, they kind of hold up a stop sign and say, no, this is the wrong model of politics. And of course, in the U.S., we'd had 8 years of presidency by Barack Obama, a man who many Americans thought should never had the right to be president. So this has happened over and over again. The other thing I would say that Trump not only legitimized extremism and all of these men they kind of give a focus to existing extremist and anti-democratic tendencies. What he added was the leader cult. And it's very, very important, this leader-follower relationship. And his victimhood cult was key in January 6th, because what he did is that he's always been the victim of the press and prosecutors in the deep state, all these things. And it was a classic fascist style, you know, paramilitaries coming to rescue their leader who was endangered, who was having something that was rightfully his stolen from them. And he has played these people like a violin. He always uses the we. The election was stolen from us, he said on January 6th at that rally. So this is why I think these authoritarian dynamics that repeat over and over again both show the appeal across classes, as Jason said, of why these figures have such, you know, have such a following, and why their rhetoric can be translated into violence at the right moment.
So, could I add on to Ruth's comment? So, I think Ruth is absolutely right in those comments, and her comments raise something that Ruth and I, in our years of talking about this in conferences and panels together, have been debating. She's looking at particular leaders, and I tend to look at the social movements. But it's both. You, as they used to say about Nazism, no national socialism without Hitler, no Hitler without national socialism. Trump adds a cult of the leader. He's remarkably skilled at the kind of mass politics that's involved here. But you had this underlying, as Ruth said, anti-democratic party. I mean, the Republicans have lost 7 out of the last 8 elections. So that means that they have to embrace an anti-democratic viewpoint that represents the democratic winners of those elections, the Democrats, as illegitimate by their nature. So inside the Republican Party, you had anti-democratic forces. Then this is happening in the United States, where the idea of a black president is already in and of itself and runs against our history. We have, the ideology of the Ku Klux Klan is a sort of fascist ideology. So that's a U.S. ideology. So you have both these anti-democratic forces, and then you have a skilled cult of the builder of a cult who can transform an already anti-democratic party into his own.
Can you both talk about how you think Donald Trump ended up becoming the leader of this movement? I mean, it did not start with Trump. We know that. But how was he able to foment so much of this extremism? Of course, the media, social media, and we can talk about that later in the show. But Professor Ben-Ghiat, what are your thoughts about how Trump, Donald Trump, ended up becoming the leader of all of this?
Well, Trump had all of the qualities that you need to be what each group needs you to be. He's amoral. He has a background in mass communications and entertainment. And I was surprised doing the research for my book how many of these leaders, really knew what they were doing before they came into office. Also had criminal records and were, you know, criminals to begin with. So that matters. But they will be what you need them to be because they are amoral. And so they managed to cobble together these very heterogeneous coalitions of people who on the surface have nothing in common. Orthodox Jews and evangelical Christians, mobsters, housewives. And what is the glue is their own person and how they give a focus and a kind of cohesion to all these disparate anxieties and unite them. When Trump talks about unity and he says, "I am your voice," this is a classic authoritarian rhetoric where they don't represent the nation like democratic leader with a small d. They present themselves as the embodiment of the nation in all of its contradictions, and they in their body will be the unity. This is very important. And this is also why they become the victim. They take the hit for the nation. Mm-hmm. So Trump had a true emotional intelligence. I don't think he's incompetent and lazy. He worked extremely hard at what he cared about most. So he had emotional intelligence. He had superb ability to manipulate the media. He had a total amoral, transactional personality, and fortunately, you need that. Again, a willingness to partner with anyone, no matter how extreme or how different they are among them. And so this started him down the path very, very well. And the last thing I'd say is he also he surrounded himself, and this I didn't realize the extent until I did the research for the book. He surrounded himself with people who had years of experience in authoritarian propaganda and psychological warfare. So Roger Stone and Paul Manafort had a lobbying firm since the 1980s, and they worked for Mobutu in the Congo, who's in my book. They worked for Ferdinand Marcos. And what did they do for Marcos? They were hired on the occasion of a snap election he wanted to call in the mid-1980s, which was widely accused of being fraudulent. So they have expertise in helping people pull off fraudulent elections. And then Manafort worked for Putin. And then you have Steve Bannon, who has dedicated his whole life to being a far-right propagandist, not just in the States, but he was trying to be a kind of focus point for the new global right in Europe. So these are very scary individuals who bring a knowledge that's decades old of how to undermine a democracy.
Professor Stanley, what would you add?
So here, Professor Benguiat and I have somewhat different frames, and I think she's 95% right about Trump there in the analysis. But I would, when she talked about, when Ruth, you talked about Orthodox Jews, Christian fundamentalists, mobsters, I think that there is more unity between those groups than might appear at first. I mean, this goes back to our original discussion in 2016 when mm-hmm. Christian fundamentalists have been the heart of Trump's support mm-hmm. since the very beginning. And that, I think, is no accident, as well as my entire family is ultra-Orthodox Jewish Trump supporters, all four of my first cousins. And they've been following the pro-Israel, the Rush Limbaugh line. I mean, you know, pro far right Israel, Rush Limbaugh line. They've been sucked in, as other white ethnics have been, to a kind of racial view of America. And the Christian fundamentalist worldview, they see Donald Trump as kind of God's sword against the godless communists, the liberals, the homosexuals. And this is actually, this reminds us of fascist movements in the past who have represented themselves, of course, hypocritically as the guardians of Christian morality and traditional morality. And Orthodox Jews here, the extreme Orthodox or the traditional Orthodox, have behaved like other fundamentalist conservative religious groups, which have, let's be frank, an authoritarian tendency to them, which is why they are often natural bases for these authoritarian leaders.
If you don't mind me asking, what do your relatives think of your work?
They don't know about it.
Oh, really?
They live really? In a different world. They live in a different, they barely know what Yale is. I mean, I don't see them often, but they live in different communities, and they're very, very, very religious. You know, it's a different world. I mean, they have every right to be who they are, but they don't. They perceive Donald Trump as their champion.
So interesting. Jason Stanley is professor of philosophy at Yale University and author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Ruth Benguiat is professor at New York University and author of Strong Men, From Mussolini to the Present. And you can find their articles at yourcallradio.org. If you have questions for our guests, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. And we will start taking your phone calls after the break, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts about how the Democrats now are attempting to deal with this? I mean, it is January 12th. We've got 8 days left. I'm reading from the New York Times right now. The House is poised to vote this evening to formally call on Mike Pence to strip Trump of his duties by invoking the 25th Amendment. The vote comes a day after House Democrats introduced an article of impeachment charging Trump for his role in inciting a violent mob of his supporters to storm the Capitol. Ruth, what are your thoughts about how the Democrats are dealing with this?
I mean, they're absolutely doing the right thing in introducing articles of impeachment, because you really can't strike a hard enough note on someone who has been a criminal all his life and showed us, if you needed any reminder of exactly who he is, and that he will do anything to stay in power illegally. I think that, I tweeted that it's not just every person involved from every branch of government and law enforcement, anyone involved in this has to have consequences, because the danger is that all of these things that Trump's been doing since he lost the election actually are like a little compendium of authoritarian tactics. So first he tried the military coup, and he was trying to sound out how about military intervention, recalling what happened in the summer. So that didn't work. Milley shut that down. And then he tried electoral manipulation, which is used by his heroes, Erdogan, Putin, and others, and, pressuring officials and stuff. And that didn't work. And so he went for the violence option with paramilitary non-state actors, although we find that some of them are indeed state actors. But what's worrying is that this is a roadmap for other people who want to do this in the future, where elections become just another, if you get an electoral result you don't like, it's just another piece of data, another piece of information that you deny, and then you fabricate an alternate one to get the result you need to stay in power. So the Democrats are not just have to punish Trump, they have to punish a whole system of lawlessness, a culture of lawlessness that he glamorized, that he legitimated, and has spread through the Republican Party like a contagion. Because there's really, it was already a lawless party in many ways, but he gave it a presidential imprimatur. So if they don't strike back very fiercely and vigorously, others will imitate Trump in the future.
What are your thoughts, Jason? Because the Biden administration, a number of people have said, we don't want this hanging over us during the first 2 months of our administration.
Oh, I agree 100% with Ruth. We started out, Ruth and I were on a show, I think it was Mehdi Hasan, in early, mid-November. And Ruth was focused, I thought then incorrectly, but I was wrong, she was right, on Trump. And she was emphasizing what Trump himself would do. And I thought, because I see the frame in terms of general ideology, I was seeing the Republican Party as a profound anti-democratic threat going forward, with Trump more as a symptom. But she turned out to be right, and which vindicates her analysis, vindicates the importance of looking at individual actors and seeing how they might behave and how they, what that they, the anti-democratic practices that they're going to do, and using their life stories as predictions. So Trump, so when Trump is gone, Ruth's analysis has predicted and helped me see that will be very good. But I also agree that, I've been focused for a long time on the Republican Party, on their base of fundamentalist white Christians and oligarchical libertarian Koch brothers who seek to this sort of mixture of billionaires, white supremacists, and fundamentalists, who are anti-democratic, and I think.
Oh, did we just lose Jason? I think maybe we lost him. We'll reconnect before.
And the minority, the dangers of a minority.
Jason, are you with us? Yes.
Oh, sorry about
that. You're back. You cut off, but you're back.
I am with you. Okay, thank you. Sorry about that. So I think Ruth is right. That there has to be some kind of accountability. Look at what happened after the Iraq war when Obama came in. When Obama came in, there was no accountability. Right. To me, there was no accountability for the financial crisis. There was no accountability for the Iraq war. There was no accountability for the torture regime. There was no accountability there was no dismantling ICE and Homeland Security. And we've reaped the consequences of that. I'm skeptical that the Biden administration will seek the kind of accountability we need. But I worry that this is the beginning and not the end.
Before we go to break, we have a related question from Danielle, who says, I'm worried that the Democrats' narrative focuses much more on the violence rather than the incessant lies that led to the violence. Why don't they clearly and forcefully highlight all of the court cases brought on by Trump and his minions, only to be thrown out by Trump-appointed judges, for example? I'm not hearing it. What are your thoughts about that, Jason?
I think they look at what deeply disturbs me is Senator Cruz and Senator Hawley and people who have no business going in for the lies, have no business adopting the big lie. I mean, I went to SUNY Stony Brook. Senator Hawley went to Stanford and Yale Law School. He's the elite of the elite. And he is adopting this as his revenge narrative. So it's moved well beyond the sort of Tommy Turbevilles or the people who probably don't know better. And it's gone into the super elite Republican leaders financed by powerful figures. And so that needs to be punished. We can't have people who graduated from Yale, Stanford, and Princeton, as Ted Cruz did, advocating what Timothy Snyder has rightly called the big lie.
Anything to add, Ruth?
I think that, you know, to the extent some of these GOP people are angry at Trump, it's because he kind of ruined the party for them. He overplayed his hand with this January 6th thing because, astonishingly and atrociously, everything else he did was just fine. All the corruption, all the violent rhetoric, all the things that your listeners know very well. And then he risks, you know, ruining everything for them because what they want to do is just say, okay, well, we'll get rid of Trump and then we can continue on because, you know, people like Pence and Mitch McConnell who have this, it's not really a last minute finding of conscience as much as a deliberate move to save all the work that they've done and all the progress they've made in their project of white minority rule under Trump. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, so we have to be careful. And they've also seen that it sells. Trump got more votes in 2020 than 2016. And had he not bungled the pandemic partly on purpose, because he doesn't care about life and profited from it, he might have won again. And so they can conclude that this works.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Ruth Ben-Ghiat is professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and the author of Strong Men, From Mussolini to the Present. Jason Stanley is professor of philosophy at Yale University and author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW San Francisco, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about how last week's insurrection happened and how it is being investigated. Off-duty police, firefighters, and members of the military are now under investigation. We have had guests on the show for many, many years talking about how white supremacists and white nationalists have infiltrated the military and police departments. So what will it take to actually take this seriously? And what actions need to be taken? If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Ruth Ben-Ghiat, professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. Her latest book is Strong Men, From Mussolini to the Present. Jason Stanley is professor of philosophy at Yale University. His latest book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Let's go to a few callers. Let's hear from, I'm just scrolling up to get the lineup. Let's go to Daria in San Francisco. Hi, Daria. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi. How are you? So first of all, I just want to say that the issue of the lies, I think, is the most important thing because it's just so disorienting when there's no justice and accountability for lies, and it kind of really frays the fabric of our culture and our society. But my question specifically today was for your guests, if they have any insight into how it is that Jews, of any kinds of Jews, religious Jews especially, but any kinds of Jews, can really reconcile their support of Trump in light of, you know, the fascism and all fascism really being so directed at anti-Semitism and all. I'm just having a hard time understanding how that works.
Well, thank you, Daria. And to add to your question, Shirley just wrote in and said, I can't wrap my mind around why people like Aaron Mostofsky, son of a Brooklyn judge who is Jewish, can riot and break into the Capitol with people wearing Camp Auschwitz sweatshirts. Likewise,
exactly.
Likewise, African Americans involved in the Proud Boys. Do your guests have insight into why people join these groups? And I just searched for this. There are a number of stories about Aaron Mostofsky, who was arrested for participating in the riots. Jason, do you want to take that one first?
Sure. Well, Trump won, if I'm not mistaken, the Orthodox Jewish vote going away. There was never any doubt about that. Let's bear in mind that Orthodox Jews, first have to see that this shows that the simple narrative that this is just white supremacy, just anti-Semitism, just patriarchy, that simple narrative isn't quite right. It's a structure here. And this structure, it's anti-communist. It represents the enemy as communist, atheist, communist, the gay agenda, taking over our universities. And so what's that? That's going to bring in Cuban Americans who are anti-communist. It's going to bring in religious members of religions who view communism, who overestimate the secular humanist threat to their way of life. It's going to bring in. So that structure, which is part of the kind of fascist politics that I study, is a structure that has always brought in a diverse group, even members of being targeted. So a lot of people hate socialism, hate communism, are homophobic, are patriarchal, and of course fundamentalist religions are that. And there's actually a lot of work done by my colleague, my colleague Ellie Stern has a piece in Tablet about this, about how there were Orthodox Jewish rabbis in the 1930s who supported the Nazis because they thought that Stalin and the communists were greater threats.
Hmm. Ruth, what would you add?
This is a larger issue of it also applies to women who, you know, white women are yes. Among the biggest, they're a very faithful Trump voting bloc, as they were Berlusconi voting bloc, Bolsonaro, all these leaders who are highly misogynistic. And, you know, gather around them domestic abusers and sexual assaulters. So you can think, why? What are they doing? Well, one of the things, and again, you see it over and over again, is that it's about the strength of the inclusive community that these men can fabricate. They traffic in illusions, in a utopia. And this idea that you can be part of this community and have status in this community is very powerful. So for women, for example, if you're a white woman, you can have, and the same was true under Nazism and fascism, you have more status than a Jew, a male Jew, or a male person of color. And so it makes people who maybe lack status in some ways feel more important. And Trump has been absolutely very skilled at making these people feel wanted. He tells them he loves them. He feels the pain. He's their voice. So we really can't underestimate this. And it pops up all over the world with the most, the leaders who you think are the most, you know, the most anti-woman are the one who have these very fervent female supporters. And so the same can be extended to the other groups.
One thing we need, a concept that's really crucial here is the concept of intersectionality. We are all part of multiple groups. White women are white and they are women. So, you know, so Ruth just gave a brilliant analysis of why someone who's white will appreciate their whiteness with this kind of politics that will resonate with them. And then they'll get, it gives them a status over their that they're not used to by being women. So we need to remember that a Cuban American is an anti-communist and also Latinx. So everyone has multiple identities. Orthodox Jews are Jewish, but they're also Orthodox. They're also funny, you know, very, very conservative.
Right. I think part of that really did come out when we looked at the analysis of why so many Latinos, for example, in South Texas voted for Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. If I can say one more thing about to answer what Dario was, the lies.
Sure.
The personality cult and is very important because it's true throughout history, and there's also been some interesting communication studies on this with Trump. Once people bond to the leader and they believe in him, they are motivated to believe whatever he tells them. But then there's another subset of people who may know that he's stretching the truth or he's exaggerating, he's playing with the establishment. And they actually like that. It's like a big FU it's this populist, you know, kind of FU in the faces of people who are, you know, who are the people he's vowing to overturn. And so this maverick personality that Trump manufactured is that the lying is part of the approval of his lying is part of that.
Yes, Clark. Yes, absolutely. There's one, I think Tim Snyder's piece this weekend adds an extra element to the lying story that Ruth told. Ruth is giving the classic and absolutely correct analysis of authoritarian lying and its role. But Snyder added this element focusing on the particular big lie that we're now seeing, the election fraud. And Ruth already addressed this earlier in the show, where she said the role of this lie is that it's a revenge narrative for the future.
And we have that piece linked on our website, yourcallradio.org, so you can find that there. Well, thank you for those questions. Let's go to another caller, Scott in Alameda. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the show.
Hey, I heard recently on this station a talk with Richard Wolff stating that, you know, one of our nation's foundations is the right to practice any and all faiths. And then in the insurrection news, I heard anarchists say we are God's army. So my question is, how do we break from that fundamentalist Christian entitlement?
Ruth, do you want to take that one first?
Well, I actually think in thinking about, you know, how do we move forward in the sense of a facile forgiveness and forgetting, but how do we protect democracy in the future? I actually think that faith interpreted in a quite different way can be a very effective bridging technique because, you know, we've already talked in the show about there's a certain authoritarian cast to certain religious cultures and religious institutions, certainly, and my research shows that, you know, religious institutions like the Vatican, et cetera, have always partnered with authoritarians very effectively. Yes. But grassroots faith, individual faith, is something quite different, and that can be, and this is part of bridge building techniques that we, it's very difficult right now because of the pandemic. We can't do these local activities together, these civil society activities together. But I do believe that a different definition of faith is going to factor in the future to how we can come together as a nation. Get over this in the sense of protecting democracy and discouraging lawlessness, not getting over it, forgetting, and all those other things that only help power.
Right. What do you think, Jason?
Well, it's this is one of the role of religion in democracy is one of the fundamental questions of democratic political philosophy, one that we're not going to be able to solve in 91.7 FM. In the next 15 minutes, or even the next hour, but that said, you know, part of the issue is that my relatives, who I believe have every right to be, have practiced the version of Orthodox Judaism that they practice, they should not see people like me as threats. I'm a secular leftist Jewish person. Well, I practice, but I'm reform, but I'm not a threat to their way of life. And so what this kind of politics that we have does is it represents people like me as a threat to fundamentalists, to P2, or to, you know, not just fundamental, you know, not just, I don't want to use the word fundamentalist, but people who are extremely socially conservative. And what we somehow need to get the message across that, you know, democracy means that we all get to live as we want. It doesn't mean that I'm going to force, you know, the gay agenda on you or whatever agenda I have. You can live as you want. And so, but we, what did.
Oh, Jason, did we lose you?
Demagogues do is they say, look, me again. So I think what demagogues do is they represent. They frighten religious faith communities by making them think that secular humanism, rather than saying everyone should live as they want, is actually a threat to their way of life.
I want to ask you both about something I've been thinking about a lot. We have been doing shows about white supremacists, white nationalists infiltrating the military and the police. These are two of the most revered institutions in the country. That, you know, in many circles, you're not, quote, allowed to say anything negative about those two institutions. And then there's a story that all kinds of people from all walks of life tell themselves and the wider population about the United States, the shining city upon a hill, you know, the best country in the world. You just hear this over and over again. And I just wonder, do you think that in many ways the media have been, you know, many members of the media have done a good job of covering Trump, but when you think about really calling this for what it is, many have really failed. Do you think one of the problems here, Ruth, is that people really don't want to look this in the face, given the story that so many people tell about this country? And I say this as someone who has or had Indigenous grandparents.
Oh, absolutely. And I was, when I wrote my conclusion to my book, which I had to turn in the summer, not knowing how the election could go, but I was so sad in writing. And I'm a first generation American. My parents are immigrants from two different countries. I was really sad in writing that it's America's turn to have to face this hard truth that, you know, it can happen here, that we're not immune from it. And in our country, you know, the first people who started writing to me when I started writing about this in the fall of 2015 about Trump were people who had fled juntas, who had fled communism. And they wrote to me and they said, we're so glad you're talking about this because no one's getting it. And, you know, America has wrecked plenty of democracies abroad, but the lived experience of people at a national level at home has been since the 1960s, you know, rights and democracy, right? And I say this since the 1960s because we weren't really a full democracy before African Americans could vote. And we've never had a foreign occupation. We never had a dictatorship. So they didn't know how to gauge what was coming. And so Jason and I and others, when we started talking about Trump being authoritarian, I published an op-ed in CNN before the inauguration. People thought we were crazy. And it's very sad that it's our turn to realize that it can happen here, and to look ourselves in the mirror. And it involves kind of taking these cherished myths about ourselves. And that includes our attraction to this kind of macho glamour that Donald Trump represents. He was lionized in the media for many, many years.
Yeah.
Despite his, there was ample information about his criminality out there. So we have a lot of soul searching to do as a nation.
Exactly. And it wasn't just Fox. I remember that he called into the Joe and Mika show on MSNBC on a regular basis, and they just let him talk. So we still have to have a reckoning about all of that. Jason, what would you add?
I would add, so Ruth and I, Ruth's a European historian, and while we overlap on some of the history she told, both my parents are Holocaust survivors, there was a difference with me. I'd been working on mass incarceration. My 2015 book used mass incarceration as its central example. I always thought it had already happened here. So you get, and in a way, one, the group I've been struggling with are people who are saying, well, you know, you're looking away from the fact that the United States is the highest incarceration rate in the world. We are a police state in large regards. Mm-hmm. Black Americans have been telling us this. They've been telling us about white supremacists in our law enforcement in, you know, very loudly and clearly since the 1960s. We've, you know, from the LA, we've had my colleague Elizabeth Hinton has a book coming out arguing that Black Americans have been doing thousands of rebellions against the police since the 1960s. Not just LA, not just Baltimore, not just Ferguson, but thousands of them. So my struggle has been trying to convince people who work on topics like mass incarceration, the American police state, that Trump actually adds something worse. Because people would say, well, look, and this is not the failure of the media. The media was oblivious to mass incarceration, oblivious. The media failed to report on how bad Bill Clinton and Joe Biden were in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. there was a mass failure to think of, I would say there was a failure to reckon with our potential for this, given where we already were with issues like race, the torture regime. So I think the media failed to talk about how we already were. You know, how will history look at us at this moment? History will say the United States had the highest incarceration rate in the world, and that was before Donald Trump. So, of course, you know, the ground was laid for this. So there are multiple failures here with the media. One, the failure to explain how bad things were. And the other failure, the failure to on the left to see that Trump added something worse.
Right. We're getting a number of emails from listeners, and we don't have that much time left. We'd love to have you both back. Just about the word fascism and how you both explain fascism and what is the nexus between fascism and populism. Ruth?
When I don't usually call Trump a fascist. I call him an authoritarian. Fascism is a subset of this broader history of authoritarian rule. Trump is the manifestation. Everything that he does and says are a manifestation of what fascism would look like in our time and place. But the reason I don't use it is it can be confusing, maybe less now, but it was confusing to people because they would say, well, what are you talking about? We don't have a one-party state. You're allowed to speak out. You're not in jail. But authoritarianism works differently today. The same tools from fascism, and Jason's book does this excellently. They span, country and time, and they come to us. But today, you don't have to have a one-party state to do the things that are to wreck democracy. You can do it in other ways. So, Trump is without a doubt leaning on many, many things of fascism, but the danger he represents is actually greater than fascism. He's channeling the age of military coups, people like Pinochet. And so you see the Proud Boys having T-shirts that say Pinochet did nothing wrong. So this is actually larger than fascism, and yet it's the inheritance of fascism. Hmm.
Jason, what would you add? We have about 2 minutes.
Yeah, so I don't wildly disagree with Ruth there. I use the term fascism, modern day fascism, but we're not in a fascist regime, because a fascist regime would be a one party state. I think of Trumpism as a fascist social and political movement. I think that the fascism is a cult of the leader who promises national restoration in the face of humiliation brought by immigrants, minorities, and liberals and socialists, and promises himself as the redeemer. I'm deeply influenced by the Black American radical tradition that has long used the term fascism to talk about Jim Crow, to talk about the elements of American history that affected European fascism, like the Ku Klux Klan. And I think that that it's important to recognize that Toni Morrison has a 1995 piece where she talks about how the U.S. has long sought fascist solutions to national problems. Her piece is called Racism and Fascism. So I think, you know, we look at our police state, we look at mass incarceration, we see that we have these longstanding elements. And I think the word, finally on the word populism, I think that's a very dangerous word. I think we should avoid the word populism because it suggests it's a way for people to look away from problems like racism, nativism, patriarchy, and blame it and say, oh, it's both a left-wing and a right-wing problem. And it's not. What we face here, you got to talk about racism. You got to do center, as Ruth does in her book, center gender. And that is not populist. It's a different problem. It's not just populism is an attack on the elite, where what we see here has these nativist, racist, patriarchal elements that need to be stressed.
Jason Stanley is professor of philosophy at Yale University and author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Jason, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Ruth Ben-Ghiat is professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. Her latest book is Strong Men, From Mussolini to the Present. Ruth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And you can find more information about their books and read their latest articles at yourcallradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, we will continue this conversation about what happened last week. How did it happen? How is it being investigated? Off-duty police, firefighters, and members of the military are now under investigation. Two Capitol Police officers have been suspended. At least 10 more are under investigation for alleged roles in the riot. The Brennan Center has long reported that police departments have been infiltrated by white supremacists. Studies have also shown connections between veterans and white nationalist movements. So how should this be dealt with? Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Joanne Marr for keeping our studio running and engineering the show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.